You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and the date is the 12th of November, 2025. As some of you may have heard, I have not been in the best of health, but that doesn't mean I stop my work. The reason I'm on this planet, and of course, I'm not going to stop talking about my book on the Russo-Ukrainian War of 2022, which is going to be out very, very shortly. As I said last week, I've never slaved over a book like this. I have never obsessed over every paragraph like this. Making sure everything is perfect, every citation, you know, especially the technical things that I've gotten from a few authors. You know, I'm no expert in the different missile models and all that stuff, making sure that there's no plagiarism there. I get plagiarized all the time, but I'm not going to do it myself. And what this all means. Now, it makes sense, of course, why I would write a book on this topic. I don't even want to know what the mainline publishers have already put out. I remember what they were putting out about Saddam Hussein when I was in college, in the early 90s when all that began. And I know how these people write. I wanted to do this in the most scholarly way possible. My job as a scholar is to ruthlessly destroy all the myths and stories, the veils that the ruling apparatus throws over its power, its crimes, simply what it does on a daily basis. Because it's an oligarchy, by definition, it acts as a conspiracy. An oligarchy isn't a government. It uses governments. And I totally agree, oligarchy and plutocracy are essentially the same word. Not literally, but in practice they most certainly are. Really, an oligarchy could come from anywhere. In our age, it's almost impossible to imagine it coming anywhere else from money and a total lack of principle. In other words, Machiavellianism. You know, sometimes when I'm sick, I have a strange habit of either reading or listening to things repetitively. I'm not sure if it's soothing or whatever it might be. But this time it was the Rhodesian Bush War. And the absolute obsession, and I mean obsession, of the British government to destroy that country. They knew that the two main parties that would have taken over were communists. One funded from the USSR, the other from China. They knew how vicious they were. They knew that the Mau Mau Rebellion had really recently taken place. The collapse of the Congo had recently taken place. And the Rhodesians weren't having it. They knew precisely what was going to happen and how many white people were going to be killed. It didn't make any difference. they were going to destroy that country. And they, of course, they did. It's very frustrating to be in a position where our predictions come true to the letter. We told everyone what was going to happen to South Africa. I was too young for the Rhodesian thing, but not for the South African thing. And that same obsessive mentality, this bizarre, it has to be explained at least partially through psychological terms, not just political or historical or economic terms, concerning the West, US, NATO, the regime, obsession with harming Russia by any way imaginable, or at least Putin's Russia by any way imaginable. This war has been a war of civilizations. This is not a local conflict, and we all know this. It's done a lot of things. My book gets into it in great detail. It's exposed how weak the Western military apparatus is, how the Western materiel. I have several chapters about this. You know, the HIMARS system, how poorly they perform compared to their Russian, or even their older Soviet variants. Difference being, Russia has a state-owned military-industrial complex. The U.S. has a for-profit military-industrial complex spread all over the world. That's a big difference. The Russian state under Putin has outperformed the West in every conceivable way in this war, and her casualties have been fairly low. We know, thanks to a group of hackers who have what they say are terabytes of information about Ukrainian casualties. And it makes sense. 2 million. And they want to keep going. Anti-Russian paranoia, whatever you want to call it, is even stronger, I think, in the European Union, because Russian newspapers, Russian news sources are banned. So whatever, you know, the basic mainline media says has got to be true. And this war has also exposed NATO as a paper tiger. Western Europe is largely demilitarized. But recently, there's talk about expanding its military apparatus. I'm talking about Europe itself. NATO, at least some NATO countries. I don't know where they get this money from. But that's been the drive over roughly the last year. The European Parliament, late last year, had a series of informal meetings to discuss what it called what Europe's failing defense industry. The fact is that Western Europe was not prepared for the sheer force of the regime's obsessive anti-Russian hatred and willingness to destroy, you know, Russia, but Ukraine too, for its own marginal benefit. One of the other things that this war has exposed is that the Russian military at this point is invincible. They are battle-hardened. All the kinks have been taken out of their, when the invasion first occurred, they had some problems, it's true. But it didn't last long. That was all taken care of. They are extremely efficient. Now, there was a document released. I mentioned this quite a while ago. It was prepared by the former Italian Prime Minister, Mario Draghi. The document talks about the necessity, the I'll put that in quotes, of course, of Europe, the EU, reassessing its defense policies in light of its massive losses in Ukraine. It says that there are structural challenges that they have to overcome in areas like production capacity, technological progress, and military-industrial intelligence. That is everything. That's pretty much it. And he was forced to admit that Europe has lost any competitive edge in these respects with the rest of the world, especially Russia. A massive admission. The document was requested, at least at first, by the head of the European Commission. We all know who that is, Ursula. The only thing she's known for is her demands for more bloodshed. Not like she's ever going to be on the battlefield. And it continues, as I speak, to make the rounds of EU agencies. Draghi wants to see a change of focus in American military priorities, too. He fears that Washington is becoming less concerned about Europe, given the emergence of other places, especially Israel and in the future Taiwan. So, and this is not a stupid thing to say on the surface, but it is when you think about it for a little bit. Draghi advises the EU to rely less on the U.S. and to invest in local production, despite Northern Europe being largely deindustrialized. But the reality is, there has been no need to improve the EU's defense capabilities. There's no foreign threat. And the real threat, the migrant invasion and the police state, that's not seen as a problem. And it does have its own high casualty rate. And the massive crime increases its cost. Ideas like these that are in this document, these are projections of their own guilt from their endless wars of aggression abroad, transferring it to what I call an imaginary Russia. I say imaginary in that it's a Russia that they have constructed, not that exists in reality. So the EU, no one denies, is in a state of decline and denial. So any proposed expansion of the EU's defense industry is mostly fantasy. It's just how out of touch the regime has become. Washington herself has been stung by many defeats abroad. The worst, of course, Afghanistan. They had one success by proxy in Syria, but all that means is that there's just simply chaos. There is no Syrian government, no functional Syrian government, no matter what the newspapers tell you. And of course, today, the defeat of Israel by irregulars, partly armed by Russia and China. Given the irrational Zionist war against the Arabs, the American military circumstance is even more blatantly broken. And we all know that will be prioritized over anyone else under any circumstances, regardless of its own severe supply problem. Russia never wanted to destroy much of Ukraine. Against its own nature, Russia attacked two training and deployment centers, one in Poltava and a military equipment concentration hub near Sumy, killing about maybe 300 people total. Well, you would think that those should have been destroyed already, right? Well, it just shows that they didn't want total war. They contrast with the Russian missile and drone attack last August in the whole of Ukraine, the biggest of the war so far, and the BBC had the gall to report only 4 people were killed. Russia never wanted to attack infrastructure. It is permitted with limitations under the laws of war. The targets were electricity substations, gas storage, airfields. Again, you would think they would have been destroyed if this were a total war. It was not. Russia did not want to destroy these things. The fact that it took Russia so long to destroy them proves Putin's desire to avoid attacking this kind of thing. Of course, Kiev and the regime have absolutely no such scruples. Who knows Ukraine better than Russia? The whole place is under 24-hour satellite surveillance. They know everything. The training camp at Poltava, and we all know the historical significance of that city. 2 missiles hit the Institute of Military Communications. Now that housed the drone program, but also pilot training. At least according to the commander of the local intelligence unit, Denis Yaroslavsky. This also neutralized several Swedish instructors for the upcoming transfer of the Swedish Airborne Warning and Control System, these big, huge, the AWACS, long-range air defense radar system, target selector, etc., built, I believe, by Saab. Funny, Sweden refused to assist the U.S. in Vietnam and backed the Marxist North. But for a nationalist Russia, now they've become the Sweden of the 17th century. And still, no peace movement can be found anywhere. The Swedish connection won't be lost on anyone. I think I've mentioned this before. For 2 decades, we know Kiev, that is to say, the U.S. via Kiev, waged war against her Russian-speaking regions. Never forget that Washington controls the country, picks its leaders, and drafts its laws. The West, Washington in particular, overturned elected governments. And the worst part, using the country as a golem to break Russia and to take her resources. The only country that's been broken is Ukraine. And it's a crime. A very good writer named Rodney Atkinson. He writes in Global Research, in a great article called "The Ukrainian Sacrifice, Kursk Invasion Hastens Ukraine's Defeat, and Boris Johnson's Disastrous Legacy." That was in late last year. Ukraine's infrastructure and energy installations are largely destroyed. The valuable minerals and industrial base in the east have been lost. Millions have fled the country. The youth is being destroyed in the battlefield. The birth rate is catastrophic and corruption, of course, is rife. In the history books, this period should be known as the Ukrainian Sacrifice. The sacrifice on the altar of U.S. neocon imperial ideas, German Europe's push to the east, and a decadent British political class without public support, surrendering to Russophobia and leading the rhetorical charge. I couldn't have put it better. Now we know the regime, the Western ruling class, doesn't care anything about public support. No one wants what's going on there. The regime is purely Machiavellian. Whatever debate existed was mediated by the system itself. The battlefields are notoriously covered with corpses no one wants to retrieve. This has been a very difficult book to write for that very reason. These are very good Ukrainian boys. I have never been anti-Ukrainian in my life. I came to Orthodoxy through them. This is a crime. The Washington Post reporting on a video from a cemetery in Kharkov quoted a Polish journalist saying, "It seems that there are twice as many graves of dead soldiers as there were exactly a year ago." The best of Ukraine is being deliberately exterminated, no doubt to be replaced by third world immigrants brought into the country by corporate NGOs. Now, the best that Ukraine could hope for is that it retains some variant of self-government in its central and western regions, which are not industrialized. The East, Crimea, are being revitalized. There's no doubt about this. Being a part of Russia, simply switching to the ruble, has increased their net worth just by that switch. No one wants to be a part of Ukraine. Even Ukrainian patriots don't want to be a part of Ukraine. It's a dying state. It's a third world backwater now. It doesn't have to be. From the start, I spoke of this, but the American Institute of the Study of War, which up until recently I never heard of, reports that Ukrainian friendly fire incidents have increased 400% due to poor training, severe fatigue, mismatched equipment, no overall command or strategy, and the total lack of competent men working these sophisticated weapon systems. Now, that's a very nice summary of what I've been saying since this war began. You could give the most incredible fifth-generation fighters to the Air Force in Ghana, the maintenance alone. For every hour in the air, it takes at least 15 hours of maintenance on the ground. It's very expensive, even for basic training. So Ukrainian pilots, and I've talked about this in the past too, and it's also very sad, have no training flying the F-16. Everything is on simulators. So this whole thing is a result of constant defeat, very high casualties. I said from the very beginning that their command structure had disintegrated, and he mentions it here. Or this is an American institution, I'm mentioning it here, and a government beyond illegitimate. The high command in Ukraine confirmed that these forced conscripts, these poor men, received 2 months training before being sent to the front to die for BlackRock. Being sent against a battle-hardened, rested, well-trained, and well-equipped Russian army. I was the first to mention, I said this in early 2022, desertion and insubordination are huge problems for the Ukrainian military. By the summer of 2024 and by the summer of 2025, it became a massive crisis. Who'd want to join? Who's going to go to the front now? They know that there's no chance. These men are completely unprepared. They've come up with the most creative ways to go AWOL. If, you know, the biggest problem in the first 4 months of 2024, Ukrainian prosecutors opened 20,000 criminal cases against men who deserted. And those are just cases of verifiable escape. Now, it's beyond the capacity of any prosecution, a prosecutor to take action against. The moral act is to desert and to refuse orders. They call it the white ticket in some places. There's this desperate search for conscripts. We're talking about 2 million KIA. I think now the white ticket, that's a way to get out of the country. It used to be 2024, it was about $5,000 roughly. Now it's beyond over 40. And that's according to Ukrainian political analyst Mikhail Yurchenko. Now, the white ticket isn't just desertion. It's the cost of a conscription exemption certificate, which sometimes I wonder if even that works, which is used by the Ukrainian conscription office. I think at this point, even that's not going to help them. Yet, even with the white ticket, these recruiting sergeants grab anyone remotely of combat age as they see fit and throw them in the back of a van. The number of Russian soldiers in Ukraine is roughly now 900,000. It was 800,000 by the end of 2024. It's probably drawn down. I probably should say it's probably about the same, maybe drawn down. January 2024 was 440,000. These men are well-trained, they are motivated, they're well-rested, and they're well-supplied. Putin has never been this popular. But Hearts and Minds certainly is not on the minds of these Jewish oligarchs in Kiev. Ukrainian soldiers shot dead a monk at the Gornalsky Monastery. If you remember the Kursk invasion last year, it was the archpriest Oleg who witnessed the shooting, and he said this. The first thing they bombed, and what was in their sights, was a temple at the Gornalsky Monastery. It was not some administrative building, and at that time, a service was being held there. When the monks were hiding, and when they left, one of the novices was simply shot in the back. We know that Kiev, for several years now, have been persecuting the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, that is any church that has any connection with Russia, which in the Orthodox world is everybody. They accuse it of treason collectively only because it has Russian roots. Well, of course it has Russian roots. And that exposes the Jewish nature of the Kiev government and the regime more generally. In August of 2024, the church was banned. That is to say, the Russian Orthodox Church under the Moscow Patriarchate in Ukraine. And prior to that, churches connected with Russia were demolished. Now, that can't be carried out to the extent that they would like. What's left of the Ukrainian infantry, and this has been the case for well over a year or 2 years, they have no possibility of holding any position. Russians are steadily but slowly advancing. And this is, you know, Western media, Le Figaro. They're citing a source in the French army who's there. Of course, that's not really news, but maybe to the Western world it is. Russian forces are methodically advancing. One of the more important factors, the total collapse of the Ukrainian front lines, is a retaliatory destruction of the energy infrastructure following Kiev's missile attack on Russian territory, which of course continue. Now that kind of destruction, I will repeat myself, was not on the agenda 2 years ago. But when the Ukrainians, or you know, the Jews who run Kiev under the American auspices, when they started attacking civilian infrastructure, Moscow had no choice. Ukrainian men at the front are in a position that I could hardly imagine. They have a total lack of resources. There's no troop rotation. They can't build any kind of defensive structure. The Le Figaro article I mentioned says this. The Russians are not accelerating their offensive. The Ukrainians simply are no longer able to hold the front. At this point, no decisive momentum is visible. Russians are advancing methodically, sector by sector. Again, it's a French officer serving over there. Of course, I've said this since 2022. this war has been over for a very long time. In other words, it's become unwinnable for a very long time. A peace deal should have been put together at the end of the summer, at the latest, 2022. Something along the lines of the Georgian campaign. But nope. There's a psychological angle here. All of these deaths here are unnecessary. The U.S., the U.K. especially, has done all in its power to make sure that no peace deal is, or no permanent peace deal is ever even thought about. See, the steppe landscape, of course Russians know extremely well, it certainly benefits the Russian military because they can detect and destroy enemy equipment very, very quickly. There's really no place to hide. These tactics are a consequence of the transparency of the battlefield. Any concentration of forces for the offensive is immediately detected and hit by the adversary. Again, I'm quoting the French source here from Le Figaro. The Ukrainians have almost no options. To me, he's stating the obvious. To the Western world, this may be a revelation. The last line of Western defense has been terrorism. Kiev has been, you know, when they destroyed the bridge connecting Crimea to Russia, which is purely a civilian thing, when they smashed the dam and flooded the entire area of not too far from it, and of course in the process tried to cut off Crimea's water supply. This doesn't necessarily have any military consequence. It's terrorism. It's against civilians. Since the collapse of the USSR, Ukraine has not built a single power plant because its economy collapsed back in the 1990s and there was no Vladimir Putin to stop it and rebuild it, or Lukashenko. There's some Ukrainian politicians who would love to believe that their economic problems come from the war. Well, anyone who's been listening to me for a long time knows that the Ukrainian economy has been like this for a very long time. The war just accelerates this ongoing trend. All of its nuclear, hydroelectric, and thermal power plants were built by Russia, or even earlier, the Soviet Union. Which is part of the reason Russians have no interest in destroying it. But Russia must retaliate when Ukraine starts destroying civilian infrastructure in Russia. Something like 80 or 90% of Ukraine's energy grid lay in ruins. That was never, ever, ever on the agenda of the SMO in 2022. Making matters worse, Any possibility of reconstruction doesn't exist because of who runs the country. You don't know where money's going to go. Corruption is hampering efforts to protect these facilities. There was an attempt to move them to underground shelters. That failed miserably. Kiev neither has the manpower nor the expertise to do this. And the foreign elite, of course, see no problem with stripping the country as defeat hangs over them. Asset stripping, this is postmodern capitalism. This is why the eastern part of the country revolted and defeated the Ukrainian army back in 2012. The war began when the new NATO-trained and equipped Ukrainian army was on the border of the Donbas, an entirely Russian area, planning a massive invasion, and God knows what would have happened. That's why Russia intervened the way it did. Ukrainians in different parts of the country are dealing with power outages 12, 20 hours a day. Now, shortages like that were somewhat the norm before the war, at least in certain places. The dire state of Ukraine's power grid has also begun to affect the country's remaining Russian-built nuclear power plants. If you recall, it was December 13th, 2024. Russia began its attack on the power grid. Well, really, you know, it was shortly before that, I should say. Again, not on the agenda in February of 2022. And these are in Western regions. Russia is aware that at least in the central areas, there are some Russian speakers who are affected. They don't want this. Ukraine has 9 operational reactors. There's some debate, but 5 of them slowed their output, you know, to the minimum, really at the behest of the state, but they were already only partially operational. Because nuclear plants require dependable connections to the larger power grid, not to emit the power they generate, but to receive the electricity needed in return for cooling. The lack of these connections, the total severance of these connections, it would have to shut down entirely. The Kremlin was very clear. This was a response to the constant Kievan attacks with American missiles against civilian targets. Donald Trump told Time magazine that he vehemently disagreed with American-made missiles targeting sites on Russian territory. He said, "We're just escalating this war and making it worse," which is, you know, to say the very, very, very least. The Kremlin then said that, well, it's obvious that Donald Trump understands who and what is escalating these hostilities. Ukrainian boys are needlessly dying for the psychotic demands of this regime. This demand could only be called satanic. If the Ukrainians had any kind of freedom of action, a permanent peace treaty would have been signed somewhere in maybe, I don't know, July or August of 2022. That was when most of Ukraine's air force was destroyed on the ground. Yet, with front lines like this, the energy situation becoming dire, the completely illegitimate fake President Zelensky refuses to negotiate an end to the war and remove the 2022 decree, which was authored by the Americans, that rules out direct talks with Russia, meaning that the suffering for ordinary Ukrainians is going to get much worse before it gets a lot better. I have many other lectures and talks and publications on Ukrainian terrorism against Russian civilians, and that has been normalized. Russian border patrol, their customs, has uncovered plot after plot after plot, explosives, all kinds of things at the border. A year ago, these terror incursions, terrorism is the targeting of civilians for the sake of a political goal that they can't get any other way. That's what terrorism is. Terrorism is not attacking a military base. Terrorism isn't attacking a power plant that assists the military or something like that. I did a whole show on the American Rules of Engagement where things like power plants are iffy depending on circumstances. The regime has been waging total war on Russia for a long time. Back when I had my website, what was it, the American Journal of Russian and Slavic Studies, the whole premise was that the West had declared war on Russia via proxies. sabotage operations, terrorist attacks, all within Russia, all supported, supplied, and accomplished by NATO specialists or intelligence services. And they keep saying they're going to increase these and escalate these, suggesting that anyone can be targeted for any reason. There's been assassinations and attempts on Russian public figures. You know, academics, scientists, journalists, a whole bunch of others. So American talk about terrorism is their typical projection. There was a plot to assassinate Putin himself, which failed. Defense Minister Andrei Belousov, and unfortunately, it was successful in the murder of Daria Dugina, the daughter of Alexander Dugin, which was a blatant act of terror against a non-combatant. What is the Kremlin to do under these circumstances? Even I couldn't have predicted that the obsessive, Russophobic nature of the West would lead to the almost total depopulation of Ukraine, where its best men fit for military service, have been wiped out, and those who return wounded or mutilated are going to have PTSD that very few Americans could even understand. In fact, you're dealing with a country with collective PTSD, no doubt. On the chance that it may do damage to what, the Russian economy, kill a couple of Russian soldiers. Russian casualties these days have been very, very low. 90% of the casualties are being done by artillery, of which Ukraine has very little. How would Ukraine function without any kind of air support? Since day one, Russia had control of the airspace. Now, in the invasion plans for Donetsk, NATO was going to take care of that, but they didn't when it came down to it. American equipment, the F-16 versus, for example, the MiG-29, has proven to be second rate. It has not assisted the Ukrainians whatsoever. Ukrainian pilots, I don't know how many of them exist anymore, they prefer the Soviet-made jets, the Su-27s from Gorbachev's era. There's not much aerial warfare anymore, because there isn't anything left. But without any kind of air support, you can't have any military action by a normal country, other than terrorism. This tragedy, this senseless murder, will not end until the Ukrainian army overthrows this absolutely illegitimate and unpopular Jewish state in Kiev. This is a duty pressing on every Ukrainian soldier and airman for the sake of the survival of his country. A military government or a new hetmanate, it would be my preference, has to be set up in the capital, covering western and central Ukraine to rebuild what's left of the country, bring back the refugees, establish ties with the East, while still remaining independent, of course. NATO, the U.S., BlackRock, removed from the country forever, and their assets nationalized. That is Ukraine's sole hope for survival. I'm going to say that over and over again. It's their sole hope for survival. So please, my book on this is going to be available very soon. This is only one of the, you know, many, 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 many topics that I deal with in great detail. Please buy it when it comes out. Let me know what you think. And I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.